with Jason Hosiers is Shooting the Ghost. Once again, I'll be talking with Phil Snyder, Bill and John Morrison. This week, we'll be focusing on the subject of male bonding, specifically centering around the Robert Bly film A Gathering of Men, and of course also on Sam Peckinpah and his opus magnus The Wild Bunch, somewhat more peripherally this week. What follows is the first part of a two-part conversation, which will continue next week. So yeah, I was thinking that we could talk about male bonding. That would be a subject that a lot of people would be interested in, whether they would admit it or not.
Yeah.
And it seems like it ties in pretty well with the Sam Peckinpah thing. I mean, his whole oeuvre is kind of refers to the whole idea of masculinity and what it is, and the rite of passage, and Wild Bunch, you know, is kind of an uber text of male bonding, you could say.
Yeah.
In a way. Exactly what it is, isn't it? Except they have to—they mm-hmm. only bond by going into their destruction together. That's what unifies them, I guess, is their suicidal impulse.
Yeah.
Thinking about that in terms of I don't know. I guess kind of like, well, first of all, like in your email, like you expressed a resistance to the whole idea of groups of men, which I thought was interesting because. I mean, I certainly can sympathize with that, like, yeah. Emotionally or instinctively, I probably feel a similar resistance to it, but I guess there's another part of me which overrides that, or particularly watching that Robert Bly thing, not that I was thinking I wish I was there at that group, but I did get a sense that those men were really searching for something, and that to some extent they were finding it just by having that space, that ritual space that he talks about, and by having a strong male figure there to lead them and to inspire them. It seemed to me that was something really valid, even if it was very kind of very sort of basic or embryonic version of what mm-hmm. it might be and what it might once have been. It still seemed like it was actually moving towards something authentic. Did you not feel that?
I can definitely see that. I mean, it was definitely had meaning and purpose for people involved with it, but like I said in the email, I just have a resistance to really it's group of any one-on-one, maybe a few people at most, but a group of people in a room together doing the same thing or involved in something. Hmm. I've never really since the first day of school, really, I've never really been able to do that very long without somehow looking for an escape. I think I sent you that an email. It's been a while back where I talked about that experience when I was in kindergarten. It was within the first couple weeks, and we had been taught how to say the Pledge of Allegiance. We're all standing there at attention, of course, with our hands on our hearts, which was required, apparently, which I found out when I decided, I looked around, and I was standing there with my hand on my heart, and the gesture made no sense to me, and everybody else was doing it, and I couldn't continue to do it because it was so meaningless to me, and see everybody else do it, I couldn't do it, I couldn't, so I put my hand down on the desk, I refused to put my hand on my heart. Teacher saw me almost immediately, and stopped the little recitation there of the Pledge of Allegiance and told me to put my hand on my heart, and I refused. And all I really remember at that point was holding on to the edge of the desk, like, really hard and refusing to put my hand on my heart, and her, like, grabbing my arm and trying to pry it off of the desk. And she finally did it, and then whacked my hand 5 times with a ruler. I remember I have this distinct, very vivid image, and it's not something that I've recalled recently to where I can say that it's false or anything. I'm pretty sure it's very accurate, because I've always remembered this as looking at my hand and how red it was, and being fascinated by the fact that how red she made it with the ruler, by hitting it with the ruler. Because I remember when I was grasping the edge of the desk, my hand was turning red a little bit because of how hard I was grasping the edge of the desk, but her smacking the hand five times with the ruler made it even redder. Mm-hmm. I remember looking at my hand and being fascinated by that, and I'm sure I put my hand on my heart from then on out, because I learned why you put your hand on your heart when you say the Pledge of Allegiance, because if you don't, the teacher will hit you on the hand with the ruler five times, you know?
Right.
But just something as simple as that, or that clown experience, seeing everyone laugh at clowns when I didn't see anything funny about them, or, you know, early school experiences. So I don't know what tainted me against all that stuff, but I
think you've just described, haven't you, what tainted you against it, because it sounds like an early imprinting of the inauthenticity of bonding, because if you're seeing, I mean, not of bonding itself, but seeing inauthentic
right.
bonding
yeah.
would then imprint you with
yeah.
the sense that bonding rituals in themselves were inauthentic, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably accurate. I mean, it's just a very strong suspicion. I'm very suspicious of any group of people doing anything in unison or such like. You know, it's you know, if I'm watching a comedy and there's just too many people laughing, it's like, well, that kind of dampens my urge to laugh, kind of thing. You know? Yeah, it's just the idea of either playing along, following rules, or responding in any way like I'm expected to respond. Mm-hmm. I immediately clam up and pull away and resist. So yeah, I mean, I could be in the most natural setting for male bonding and probably still resist. But I don't know what that is. It's probably a lot of it's just being a loner type person. But yeah.
Well, it's very Aries quality.
Yeah, yeah,
for sure.
That very well could be it. So that kind of thing. It's like if I see people doing it and there's any hint of absurdity to it or anything that I can't totally buy into, then I can't do it. I can't do it, you know?
Well, I think that's probably pretty common, wouldn't you say, in guys?
And I mean, yeah.
I mean, isn't there a basic kind of fear that comes out as ridicule or just resistance to any kind of male bonding thing?
Yeah.
That it's basically gay, you know? There's something just...
Well, yeah.
...faggy about it. Which is ironic.
Exactly.
Because it's the reverse, isn't it?
Yeah.
Potentially.
In theory, but if... You know, like I mentioned in the in my response to my email to you after you sent the Robert Bly clip, and I watched most of it. It's like all the men sitting there with their beards. There was a lot of facial hair, mm-hmm. you know, and it didn't seem like a genuine sort of male thing. It seemed like an attempt to get to something genuine. And I'm not sure if you can really get to anything genuine in a setting like that, but maybe, you know, there was some truth to it. And I got into some of the things he was saying, so. But I could never be a part of that audience, I don't think. But yeah, that whole, you know, afraid of the faggy aspect of it. But it's not so much afraid of any latent homosexuality or anything like that. It's for me, it's the absurdity of it.
And I listened to Phil this morning.
Oh, right on, excellent.
And that was very interesting. His impression of that whole business. I have beards every once in a while. It's really funny having him talk about beards.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I understand what he's saying. I couldn't have gone out there either.
Not that I'm saying it's absurd, but I would feel completely absurd to go along with it. I'd have to be at the back of the room at the very least. You know what I mean?
Right. But isn't that? I mean, isn't that do you think? I mean, where does that come from? You know, why would you feel absurd?
Oh.
I mean, why is there such a strong reaction? I mean, okay, if it is absurd, but I mean, you wouldn't be interacting with the audience anyway. You'd just be watching Robert Bly. So if you like,
right,
or respond
right.
to what Robert
right,
Bly is saying, why be self-conscious about being in a room full of men?
Right. I could attend a lecture in a situation like that, but I would not be able to attend a 3-day retreat and do the heron dance or whatever he was talking. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I couldn't do the whole bit. I mean, I can go and sit through a lot of different things. I'm just not going to. you know, when it comes to the time for everybody to stand up and chant together or whatever it is that you would be doing, I would not be doing that.
But you wouldn't.
Of course, if I go to a baseball game, I do not stand up and put my hand up. Still, don't put my hand on my heart and say, you know, when they sing the national anthem or, you know, anything group behavior sort of thing. I will not participate.
Right.
Well, I've always been a non-participator. Yes.
Well, yeah, I mean, I am too, but...
Yeah.
I mean, that's more to do with, or I'm beginning to realize that that's more to do with just not finding the real, authentic opportunity for group bonding.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of what we're both basically talking about the same thing, is that I think that a three-day retreat, Robert Bly-led retreat, would be somehow, to me at least personally, inauthentic and not getting to the real meat of it. So yeah, it's inauthenticness that I would be reacting to more than anything. So for some people it could be authentic, but it doesn't connect with me.
But can you imagine
the lectures and the ideas and the concepts, of course, would. What did you say?
Well, I mean, so, well, I was going to say, could you imagine an opportunity that would be authentic? Can you imagine a situation, a ritual space, or a
be.
Group in which
it could be? It would have to be probably spontaneous, I would think. Don't ask me to like draw a picture of what it would be like, because it wouldn't be spontaneous then if I knew when to recognize it. I just feel like it probably exists out there somewhere, and I would recognize it when I see it. But I don't think it would be something at a Holiday Inn banquet room with admission and tickets and t-shirts and, you know, any sort of, you know, especially if I'm in a group and I look around and there are a lot of similar looking people, that will get me too. I mean, that's why I reacted to the beards. It's like beards, 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 beards. I would get paranoid with all those beards around me, you know? Mm-hmm. And then if I hadn't shaved that day, I would be worried. Maybe they think I'm one of these beard types. Maybe, I don't, you know, and then I would become very obsessed with everything. And then I probably would, right, I'd have to leave.
So
you know, one way or the other, I'd have to get out of it.
So it's a self-consciousness, then, primarily, that would be interfering.
Right, yeah, it's self-consciousness, but not because of just the simple fact of self-consciousness, but self-conscious that I am, perhaps, in the middle of a group of people who are doing that one thing that I can't do, which is following along and participating and in any way being like them. Uh-huh. I wouldn't... It just, you know, it's a very involuntary response sort of thing with me. I can see it happening, you know, like I say, in smaller groups, it would be much more possible. I would never do a, let's have a men's getaway thing. You know, you see the, like, you see some of those commercials for, like, what is it, Flomax, where men who have a urinary tract problem and they can't stop taking a leak or whatever it is, and they're all off, and they're in a, like a, there's four guys of the similar age, you know, gray hair, and they're all in like a red convertible, and they're going across country or whatever, and stopping at diners and things, and one of them keeps missing out on things because he has to pee so much, you know.
Where's Phil?
Well, Phil is mowing the lawn or something useful. He's like, he's been otherwise employed by the universe.
Really?
Hmm, yeah.
There's this one woman that I work with at work. She had a girls' weekend sort of thing where her and her girlfriends like went out camping by I think it was Indian Lake here in this vicinity. Nobody hearing this, of course, would know about Indian Lake. I'm sure every area has its Indian lakes, but yeah, I'm just that idea of, oh, let's go out and just let loose and be free, and you know, I could never do it like arranged.
Well, I was supposing it was you, me, Bill, and John doing it then, you know. I mean, isn't that what we're doing on the internet in a way? And we're creating,
yeah,
this space,
right? Yeah, that's true. But again, that's a small group sort of thing. But the idea of making it a weekend and calling it a guys' weekend, and then if you did more and more added more and more things, piled more and more aspects like that on, then it would reach a certain critical mass and I couldn't continue to participate.
Well, yeah, that's what I'd be curious about. I mean, and this isn't all about you, by the way. I'm just asking the questions because
right.
You know,
we're
turn
just,
this
we're kinda,
around,
yeah.
And I'd be saying some of the same things, but At what point does it become threatening, if I can use that term, or just unpleasant, or unappealing?
Oh, unpleasant? It's you know, it goes back to that same thing. If I was in that audience from the video clip, and I saw all the beards, especially if I hadn't shaved in a couple days, because a lot of times I don't do that. And then it's like, now I'm in this group of people, and it's just a unconscious paranoia sort of thing. Or the experience when I was in kindergarten, standing there with my hand on my heart, not understanding the gesture, looking around and seeing everybody else doing it, and then realizing that I'm part of that.
Okay, but so we were talking about the four of us going on a group thing, and you were saying that at a certain point that would start to become unappealing or even threatening. So, is it for what?
It would have to just be the individuals and not have a name like this. The woman at work, it was like a girls' weekend or whatever she called it. You know, let's have a guys' weekend. You, me, Bill, and John, and we'll go out and we'll do these prearranged activities and we'll. This and we'll bond. Well, let's bond, you know.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going to bond with anybody who says let's bond. You know what I mean? That's right. I'm not going to bond with you.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem natural, and it seems fake, and it's absurd. And then you mentioned self-consciousness. It's not so much a fear of embarrassment or anything like that. It's just an intense self-consciousness where you just can't, you know, I can feel every hair on my arm, you know, I could just, you know, and it's just too, you know, it's a paranoia almost. It's a paranoia that just would overtake me, I guess. You know, so many things go back to my youth, but they also go, you know, they just, it's for whatever reason, it's coming up now, I guess maybe because I'm trying to express how these things seem to be intrinsic to who I am and seem to originate at a place where I can't fully explain them because it's just how I am kind of thing.
Moving on. Time to move on. What's next on the agenda? Fragmented dialogues.
Your brother didn't take care of you as a kid?
No, on the contrary. He was the only time that we bonded was when he wanted to get up to mischief, and he would sometimes recruit me for that. And so that was the only time we actually did stuff together, was when he wanted to do something bad and he would kind of draw me into that. And of course I would be happy just to do anything with him, so I would end up getting into trouble.
We've spoken about I think it was last time, we talked about friends, like did when we were in our early teens, and teens, did you have friends? What kind of personality were you, sort of thing?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is earlier, and I think I had mentioned that I had a very close friend when I was like probably between the ages of 4, I guess, up till about 8. Jimmy McGarvey, who lived down the street from me, from us when we lived in an area here called Beaver Creek, sort of like a countrified sort of area. So, you know, there's a lot of playing outside and that kind of stuff. So I remember we were at, I was over at Jimmy's house, and there were like 2 or 3 other boys there. I can't remember who they were. I think 1 or 2 of them were strangers. And we had like run out of things to do. It's like we didn't know what else to do. We were just kind of standing there. And Jimmy, who was like, I wouldn't say he was the leader of the group, but he was an intelligent kid, and he obviously was a lot more appreciated by his parents maybe than some of the other kids were, because he was always, you know, his mother was always telling him things about how great he was, how smart he was, you know, and he would repeat them back, you know. And he just seemed to have a little more ego, I guess, maybe, than the rest of us. But anyways, he said, I know what, and I've been thinking a lot about this experience because it seems to apply to a lot of things in my life. And I still get some of these feelings that come up, even, you know, up till the day, and they probably will continue for the rest of my life. He hatched a plan. He said, let's pretend there's a giant invisible 50-foot-tall robot over there. And he pointed over, there was like a yard that had like a little hill on it. And we have to run around and around in circles around it to confuse it and make it fall over.
Mm-hmm.
I guess he probably based that on an episode of Lost in Space that he'd seen or something. Like, it was a very Lost in Space sort of idea, you know, if you're familiar with that American television program. No. Anyways, so we went over there and said, yeah, okay, sound, you know, basically went off. You know, we ran over to that spot and we started running around this giant invisible 50-foot tall robot. I'm pretty sure that's exactly what he called it. It was, you know, how he came up with it too. He said a giant invisible 50-foot tall robot. Anyways, we're running around in circles, screaming, yelling, yeah, yeah, you know, waving our arms and confusing this giant invisible 50-foot tall robot. And it's probably maybe, you know, I was into it maybe the first time, and the second time, and the third time, and the fourth time. We're still doing it. And then I start thinking, man, enough of this already. There's no 50-foot giant invisible 50-foot tall robot, but I'm still doing it. And I'm running. And the other kids, they're still into it. You know, they're still waving their arms and screaming, yeah, right, you know. And by this point, it's probably like 8 times, 9 times, 10 times, and I'm not yelling and screaming. I'm not into it. I'm just running around in circles because that's what we're doing. And I'm getting tired. It's like, it just seemed insane and absurd for these boys in front of me. You know, we're all the same age, so it's not like, you know, I was any more wiser than they were or had more or less imagination. I think we all probably had the same amount of imagination. I don't think it was an imagination deficit that made me begin to doubt it. I mean, I knew there was no giant invisible 50-foot tall robot there, but they were behaving as if they actually believed it, you know, and they were still screaming and yelling and into it. And it's maybe 12 times, 13 times, and then it hit me. It's like, I don't have to keep running around in circles and to confuse this non-existent giant invisible 50-foot tall robot. I can run home. And it was just like a revelation to me. So I just, instead of running around circles, I broke the circle and I ran off home. And they all stopped and said, where are you going? And I just, I don't know what I did. I probably just waved at them, or I don't think I knew about the finger, so I didn't give them the finger, but I would have gave them the finger. But it was such a feeling of freedom that I can still recall that, I think. You know, it was very much like something, learning to do something for the first time, realizing, you know, how, you know, that you can climb a tree or you know, catch a ball, or, you know, some original experience of finally getting, finally learning how to do something sort of thing. Maybe I have leaned upon that a little bit too much, but I still get that feeling sometimes, like at work, if I'm doing something stupid.
Hold on. Let's backtrack then before you go on to another story.
It was a natural thing to be protective of your family. Even if you're a coward, you do it in a way, because I am a physical coward.
You know, I was a coward more than Bill. I would talk my way out of things, and I couldn't fight. I went to a party when I was a senior in high school, and a lot of guys were there. Norm Patera, big, strong, very strong fella, played football for the team, and a lot of big guys. They're all, most of them athletes, because I was in a club with a lot of athletes, and I was sort of like the odd man out there in that regards. But they liked me. I was sort of like their funny, you know, I was the clown. And a bunch of guys from Jefferson High School came to the party and wanted to fight. Of course, I backed off immediately and went into the other room. And, well, it all went outside, and I was watching it from outside. I went outside too, and this guy comes up to me. He's dancing around, you know, and he's doing kind of a, you know, Muhammad Ali thing, you know, around me and stuff. And I kept looking at him. I had a few beers, by the way, but I kept looking at him as if, what the fuck are you doing, you know? But he just kept looking at me, and I just stood there, and he says, oh, you're not worth it. And then he walked away, you know.
Isn't that what bullies say when they're actually afraid to fight? Ah, you're not worth it.
No, I wasn't staring him down. I had a few beers. I really didn't know what he was doing. Dancing up and down like that, it is totally foreign to me.
Well, I'm not worth it. Statement is absolutely accurate, at least for some people, because they would, why bother with somebody?
Well, don't you think that fighting for a lot of guys is actually a way of bonding in a weird way, connecting to other men?
Sure.
What you just described was you breaking free of a male bonding right.
Right.
For kids.
And
right?
And the exhilarating freedom that comes from doing that.
Mm-hmm. your discomfort that you were describing, like when you realized that you were just going along with this make-believe thing because that seemed like the thing to do, you know, because everyone else was doing it, so you were doing it too. So isn't that kind of parallel to you imagining yourself in the audience for Robert Bly and looking around and seeing all these men with beards and being worried that you had a beard too, and that, I mean, this is part of the same thing, maybe, of like loss of identity,
right?
Actually being integrated into the group,
right?
Which I suppose
integration into the group. That's it, right there. Then.
Well, Bill and I were brought up in, our dad. As a kid, I know that I listened to the fights all the time with Dad. He had the radio on, and there was nothing for me else to do. But you know, I was always around the house, and I listened to it too. And it was very exciting listening to it on the radio. I listened to the Joel Lewis, Joe Walcott fight, and Marciano, and all those boys. Robin, I was a fight fan too. I used to, in high school, I had the Fight magazine. I forget what it was called. It's called Ring, I guess it was.
Which is what male bonding is all about, or at least that's an aspect of it. But that would be anathema. Yeah. Well, it would be anathema to an Aries, you know, just in his nature.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, to I don't know actually where I was going to go with that. I mean, because I feel I totally identify and relate, and yet at the same time, I mean, did you ever? Were you ever into sport when you were growing up? That whole male
thing? Oh, no, not really, no.
Mm-hmm. Me neither. In fact, I hated it. I found it terrifying.
Yeah, I wouldn't say terrifying. The few things I tried, I actually could do things fairly well. But I resisted it for many of the same reasons. I mean, to this day, I can barely play like a board game or a card game with other people because something in my mind will not allow me to remember the rules or pay attention. I start to drift away and think of other things that I could be doing, you know? And it really takes devotion to that, you know, subjugation, I guess, maybe, of your ego to the rules of a game to play along with the game for too long. Right. I mean, I'm not saying that my urges or tendencies are better than the opposite. It probably would have been better to continue running around in circles and play along with the group and be part of the group. I can't say that I've never envied that, because I have envied that experience, but it's just something that I can't quite manage. And you had made a connection between that and the Robert Bly experience and how I looked at the beards and interpreted what I was seeing going on in that lecture or performance or whatever you would call it that Bly was doing. I mean, that's the exact correct connection that I was hoping would be apparent. And the reason I went back to the earlier experience is that seemed to be one of the pivotal, almost archetypal experiences of what I'm trying to get across here that probably serves as a model for the later expressions of it. I'm sure I had other things before that. This was, I mean, if I got the chronology correctly, this would have been after the Pledge Allegiance experience from kindergarten, you know, so obviously it existed before that. But this was coupled also with a feeling of freedom. So there's this freedom when you break ranks and you run away. Right. And, you know, it's not like, oh, I'm going to go home because I'm a mama's boy or there's safety at home. I probably went off and did my own thing when I was at home. I might have went to the backyard and played by myself.
How old were
you? But I was no... Oh, this is probably about the age of 6, maybe.
With the robot thing?
Yeah, the robot thing, yeah.
Wow.
And then the Pledge of Allegiance, of course, would, like when I was around 5 years old.
What keeps us going is the abrasion, the conflict, the yin and yang, the back and forth, the black and white, and all that's in between, and we're all of it. We're capable of being these bullies, these people, these Sam Peckinpah's actor friends, actors that he uses in his movies. I was so fascinated by that conversation that that's really what was on my mind that you and Phil had. John, did you listen to that?
Yes, I did. Yeah, it was fascinating.
Wasn't it? And right there in itself, you have answered your question, if there was any, or mine.
But that feeling of freedom, I mean, I had that today when I left work. I mean, this project we're working on, I won't go into that. This is kind of what I started going before. It's what we're doing is so futile and so meaningless, and it has been acknowledged by the entire group that there's really nothing we can do, but we're just going through the motions because that's what we're supposed to do, and we have to wait until there's like a software development that occurs on the 18th. Only from the 18th onward can we actually get anything done. Until then, we're supposed to like pretend like we're being productive, but everyone else is playing along and pretending like they're being productive, and I keep stopping and looking and around the room and seeing that people are active, but they don't really seem to be doing anything productive, and they're probably sitting there frustrated, but they can sit there and do that. I can't, so I just said, I just stood up and said, I got to get out of here, and I left. You know, I just couldn't do it.
And you had
I couldn't
the same,
go through those motions, and that... Yeah, I would say that's a very similar experience. That's the, you know, it's like I just realized that I'm chasing a giant invisible 50-foot tall robot. You know, and it doesn't exist. And I need to stop right now. See you later. So I went home, you know, and it was great. It was fantastic. I felt free. You know, I quit jobs like that.
Right.
Where I'll be doing something that's totally absurd and insane. And then I say, I gotta go. And then I literally just like walk out. And the feeling of freedom that comes then too. I mean, we were kind of losing the theme of male bonding and some of the other
Peckinpah
related
find stuff. Our way back.
Yeah,
if we try.
Yeah.
John, did you see that?
I watched it again.
I couldn't watch it all. I watched the last third, I think.
So. I was very much interested in it. Not doing what they did. I agreed with Phil about, you know, I wouldn't want to be going around doing the heron dance unless I was half swacked or, you know, taking some acid or something. I wouldn't mind doing it, but
to get psychological as I like to, it seems like you're describing something again that I think probably most people can relate to, because I think it's a Western thing of the ego, but particularly in Aries male and particularly outsiders like you or I, is this defining ourselves by our refusal to be integrated. You know, defining ourselves by our capacity to say no, which is a rebel. It's a rebel thing, isn't it? Which is very much idealized in our culture by the movies and the myths and what have you. The hero is also the rebel. He's the one who actually goes against the grain. This is you're describing something that's positive, even though it's a negative positive or a positive negative, because you're actually rebelling against something that you perceive to be phony and inauthentic, and so it's giving you the opportunity to define yourself, get a more clear sense of who you are. So you could say it's like individuation, but then on the other hand, if we start to define ourselves by what we're not, you know, then we get locked into this rigid ego structure, which is the kind of negative side of the rebel, which is basically it's just an ego trip, isn't it? Because a rebel isn't a team player, so he's not going to cooperate with anything. He's not going to integrate with any movement or any group after a certain point, because he's become defined and locked into that identity as the guy who doesn't join, the guy who's not a team player, which is the way I am, and it's definitely the way you are. And the thing is you, you're also, of all the people I know, you have one of the most fully developed senses of self-loathing. You know, your sense of ego is very strong in a negative sense. You know what I mean by that?
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if they're related, these two things.
Oh, yeah. I would definitely say so. I mean, that's always the I guess you could say the danger with breaking ranks or running away. Will you keep running? You know, will you never ever try to return and integrate yourself into the group in any way? How rebellious will your rebellion become? Will you, you know, what else are you going to refuse to do? all the way to obeying laws, the Ten Commandments, whatever. Are you going to start killing people? I mean, you could. Charlie Manson wasn't a group player, you know, he didn't play along with the group either. Hmm. He wanted to lead the group, of course.
Well, that was where I was going to go with that.
There's a shadow side to all that. I mean, there's a shadow side to all that.
Listening to you talking, I mean, yeah, there's right. the one hand, yeah, the rebel thing can go so far that it becomes pathological or psychopathic. But then there's also the question of, like, if you have that rebel instinct in you, what's it good for? It's not just a negative thing for rejecting the inauthentic. It means that you have the capacity to lead and to create an authentic group thing. That seems to be what it would have to be for. Otherwise, what's it, you know? There's no point in just rejecting everything if you're not actually going to use the energy of that rejection to find or create a real group, you know, or a real unification, right? So then you bring up Charles Manson. I mean, is a perfect example. Well, he's a perfect negative example of that. He's the rebel who then created his own reality. You know? And
right.
So
right.
I mean, this is back to what I was saying earlier, like the baby in the bathwater. Like, if our first experience of male bonding or any kind of group integration is negative, is and we're able to see it as inauthentic, then we get imprinted with the association that all such enterprises are inauthentic, they're bogus, they're absurd. And I think that there's that kind of cooperates or conspires with something else in us which is much deeper, which is this basic terror of being integrated into a group, even in a good, or especially in a good healthy way, which would also be loss of identity, but not in the sense of just becoming a robot, but in the sense of actually surrendering to a group consciousness and actually becoming nothing to become everything, you know, surrendering the ego in order to open up to collective consciousness or collective ego, and that is terrifying to us. And so, like I say, the suspicion, the healthy suspicion of integration and bonding, combines with the deeper unconscious terror of it, and so then we use that distrust as a way to avoid it. You know, for the rest of our lives, potentially, and stay in our cave, as you once put it. I also wouldn't necessarily want to be in that group. I would go and see Robert Bly speak because I'm interested by him, and I think he's a powerful example of something that I would aspire to be and hope to be. It used to be just the most basic function in a tribal society, was somebody who knows how to create that ritual space.
I think he was giving us back our place as men, in a sense, when you hunted together and we played golf together and all that crap, but that's more competitive. When you hunted together, you went out to hunt together. Pardon me?
It didn't expand me, and it was like I don't need to hear this. His dad was not my dad. There was nothing there, other than the intelligence behind it, the practicality, gathering for men to get together and not feel the need to prove that they were males or men, perhaps even, and just be whatever that is. And I guess John and I are expressing that in you as well, and that we are who we are, and this is why we are being as we be, is because of some of those experiences that happened.
Well, you know, Bill, I think that it expanded me in the sense that in my relationship to women, I don't know, it just gave me more space, if you want to use that term, with whoever I was with, you know, at the time, because there's that whole female-male, I mean, with my marriages and everything, you know, thing going on.
There was nothing there I needed. That's what we were doing. That's what we did, all of us. I tell you, I think these Portland, Oregon people and all of their simplistic shit-kickingness has a spirit of, you know, you just were there with, I don't know, there weren't these conflicts, these types of things that were so complicated. They were there within all of us. Of course, we went home and watched our television by ourselves in the summertime, had nothing to do, and wondered about ourselves. But I really have an offense towards the man. now that we're talking about it.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, because I think it's because you're, I think there's a little fear in there with this, Bill, with how you feel about it. You feel some kind, you feel threatened. You feel threatened by this.
Yeah, I mean, there's an authentic, genuine, powerful, healthy, insert word here, way of doing the bonding thing and joining a group, becoming part of the group, let's say transcending. I don't know if that's the correct word. The individual, separated, disconnected ego. And then there are more and more versions of... there's levels that are more inauthentic, all the way to complete fake, lie, non-existent, you know, just totally superficial, bogus, just a facade of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I have never really experienced maybe a few glimmers here and there. A truly authentic, genuine experience of that. I've never really had that. You know what I'm saying?
I think you're missing my point, Bill. It's not that I was trying to find myself as a place, as a man in society, amongst men. It was my relationships with women that it helped. And I don't think you can understand that, because... I just don't think you can. You weren't where I was with these women, and
I was missing your point. I mean, I don't know where I indicated I didn't get your point.
That's a good ideal, but I've never seen that ideal in action because maybe my opinion is just too low and I'm too cynical and too critical. And maybe I've seen it 100 times and never recognized it because my perception is skewed. That could be true also, but I kind of feel like my perceptions are fairly accurate. I think most of the examples I've seen have been very faulty, very incomplete. I've gotten a little bit out of those occasionally, things like that, but it never really goes too far before I reach that experience of seeing that it's absurd and it's not working and I just can't do it anymore, and then I run. I'm off. I quit.
Before we leave off then for this week, is what does any of this have to do with Sam Peckinpah? Well, the answer is everything and nothing. As we've already discussed to some extent on this show, Sam Peckinpah was a sensitive soul, poetic by nature, an artist, and he, to a large extent, he rejected his family tradition, specifically that of law. His father and his grandfather were both judges, and Sam chose a career in the arts over a career in law. He did join the Marines when he was a young man, coming of age, just at the end of World War II, and he often spoke of that time as the best time of his life, somewhat disingenuously, but nonetheless suggestive, I think, that whatever he experienced in the Marines was defining to him, and that within the Marines and the military, Sam experienced a kind of bonding to other men that he wasn't able to experience at any other time in his life. And it was often commented on how Sam applied his training in the Marines to his work as a film director, as a leader of a group of individuals, mostly men, not entirely, towards the accomplishment of a mission. But overall, anyway, Sam, he was not a joiner. He was not a team player. The word maverick is frequently used in conjunction with Sam Peckinpah. Maverick is a horse that can't be broken in. Can't be ridden. Sam was broken in eventually, but it was only by breaking his spirit that it was possible. Because Sam Peckinpah made films about men who were outcasts, rebels. His most famous work was an ode to and the need the outsider to band together with like spirits, kindred spirits, rebel spirits. Because the title itself, The Wild Bunch, says it all. Robert Bly talks about the wild man, how we need to get in touch with the wild man as males. Peckinpah also referred to his closest confederates, compadres, as dog brothers. But Sam's own life itself was a very poignant narrative, just like the Wild Bunch, in a much more complex fashion to the doomed nature of the rebel spirit. The trouble with Sam was that he just couldn't play ball in Hollywood. He just would not toe the line. He would not pledge allegiance to the Hollywood system, or to the flag for that matter. He refused to dance around an imaginary 50-foot robot of corporate control and commercialism. It would be more accurate to say that he did dance around that robot, but he resented it fiercely and could never quite convince himself that the robot was real. He never felt at one with the group which that he was obliged to integrate with just to get his movies made. This is why Peckinpah always felt like a whore and described himself as a good whore who goes where he's kicked. So the more that Sam allowed himself to be integrated within the Hollywood system in order to work, the greater his self-loathing became, and the worse his alcoholism. You could say that Sam was aware of the inauthentic nature of the bonding ritual that he was involved with, bonding with other men who were not interested in connecting to the primal, but merely in making money. Sam was the rebel leader who briefly had a cause in making movies, but eventually lost sight of that. And just like Pike Bishop in The Wild Bunch, he was all washed up finally on the shores of a new era, which he could neither submit to, but that couldn't assimilate him, at which point he had no choice. I mean, he had nowhere to lead the troops except to their destruction. Must have been somewhat how Sam's crew may have felt on those last few movies. And Sam's love for Mexico is very central to this whole narrative, and that he always returned there sooner or later. He made as many movies there as he could, and part of him, I think, must have been desperate just to run away from the 50-foot robot, imaginary dancing, bonding, inauthentic ceremony of Hollywood. It was just to run away to Mexico and make movies on the cheap there, or just retire completely. There's no doubt that he must have had that urge, but he resisted it. He just couldn't turn his back on that 50-foot robot. But he went there whenever he could, and he made his movies there whenever possible. And of course, his movies romanticize that. They show that deep affinity he had for the Mexican people and for the land, Mexico lindo. And I think because Mexico embodied or represented a place and time where men were still able to hold a ritual space for each other, apart from the world of women. Of course, that's very much demonstrated in The Wild Bunch, which women barely have a place at all, except as whores, and briefly in Angel's Village, which is a brief respite for The Wild Bunch, where they have a taste of paradise, only to ride out back into battle and to their destruction. And The Wild Bunch was Sam's ode to that world, but also his lament that he would, just like the bunch, never be able to find his way back there. At least not in this life. seen a man standing over a dead dog by highway in the ditch. He's looking down, kinda puzzled, poking the dog with a stick. He's got his car door flung open, oh, out on Highway 31. Like if he stood there long enough, that dog get up and run. Which struck me kinda funny, seemed kinda funny suddenly. How at the end of every hardened day, people find some reason to believe. Oh, Mary Lou loved Johnny with a love mean and true. She said, I work for you every day and bring my money home to you. One day he up and left her, and ever since of that, she waits down at the end of that dirt road for young Johnny to come back. What struck me kind of funny, seemed kind of funny indeed, how at the end of every hardened day, people find some reason to believe. Oh, take the baby to the river, Carl William they call him. Oh, wash the baby in the water, take away little Carl's sins. In a whitewashed shotgun shack, an old man passes away. They take his body to the graveyard, and over him they pray. Oh Lord, won't you tell us, tell us what does it mean, how at the end of every hardened day, people find some reason to believe. Oh, congregation gathers down by the riverside. A preacher stands with a Bible, groom stands waiting by his side. Oh, congregation gone, the sun sets behind a weeping willow tree. Groom stands alone and watches the river rush on so effortlessly. And he's wondering, where can his baby be? Till at the end of every hardened day, people find some reason to believe.